Welcome to Cleveland Clinic Cardiac Consult, brought to you by the Seidel and Arnold Miller Family Heart and Vascular Institute at Cleveland Clinic. In each podcast, we aim to provide relevant and helpful information for healthcare professionals involved in cardiac, vascular, and thoracic specialties. Enjoy.
I'm delighted to see so many of you here this morning for our grand rounds. It's a very special occasion. As you know, we have a crisis in overdosing in the United States. There were 70,000 deaths in 2017. And here in Cuyahoga County in 2016, there were 814 deaths from overdose. It increased in 2017 and then went down, and it looks like it's increasing again here. And as you heard over the weekend, there were a number of overdoses. This morning on public radio, there was also discussion about this issue. And so we thought it would be important from the point of view of our community to discuss this, and I'm delighted that Councilman Blaine Griffin, whom I've worked with on other projects, is here to join us. Thank you very much, Councilman. And to talk a bit about also the community. And then our great pleasure and honor is to have the Surgeon General of the United States here. He's the 20th Surgeon General. He has obviously a medical background. He grew up in Maryland and went to university there in his undergraduates, and then went on to medical school in Indiana on a scholarship, you know, University of Indiana. Eventually did anesthesia there, but also took time to do a public medicine degree at the University of Berkeley. He also has done a lot of research as an anesthesiologist. He had an interest and published on the use of non-opioids for orthopedic surgery, and also had an interest in alternative methods of treating patients. I looked at his CV, and obviously, like anybody who's going to introduce a physician, I looked up PubMed to see his article that he wrote in Zimbabwe. And I put in Adams, Jay, and then, of course, you get a whole lot. And Adams, obviously, is not an uncommon name. There were 582 articles. The first one was related to Africa. In fact, South Africa claims this island a bit south of South Africa. And you may know it as Antarctica, but it actually should belong to South Africa. There's a lot of dispute about that. And then I looked up this recent publication by Dr. Adams, and this is what it read. This is 2 weeks ago. Bacterial community composition and diversity respond to nutrient amendment, but not warming in maritime Antarctic soil. I obviously could see that this was not a Trump administration project. And so it was obviously not our Surgeon General involved. In fact, that Adams is of all things from Nanjing. So, but Dr. Adams has had a long interest in the whole issue of opioids. He has had two main missions, and that is to deal with the opioid crisis, and secondly, deal with mental health disease. And as you know, there was a recent publication, JAMA, came out. There were 85,000 kids from the age of 10 to 19 who committed suicide from 1985 to 2016. That's more than people died, soldiers who died in Vietnam. And if you think about not only the loss of life to the family, the whole future of that potential generation and its effect on the United States, it is a tragedy to see things like that. So it's my great pleasure to introduce him and to have him address us and his passion around the whole issue of the opioid epidemic. He's done a lot of things for this. I'm sure he'll touch on what he's done with naloxone and also clean syringes and needles. Thank you very much for joining us, Surgeon General. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone. It really does feel like grand rounds because there are a bunch of empty seats right here in the front. Everyone is scared. I'm going to ask them questions, but I'm not gonna try to put anyone on the spot, but I am going to put everyone on the spot right now, and I'll start off with one just to get everyone involved and get the juices flowing. Raise your hand if you know CPR. Look around you. You see how many hands are up? I love it. Okay, now raise your hand if you carry naloxone with you everywhere you go. Notice the difference? The fact is, you had 8 overdoses over the weekend here, right in the Cleveland area. The chances are much greater that someone's going to come in that back door right now and say someone is overdosing in the bathroom and needs help than they are that someone's going to come in that door and say someone needs CPR. You saw how many people would respond if you needed CPR. You saw how few people could actually respond if they needed naloxone. And so one of the things that we need to do is start walking the talk. And one of the things that I did as Surgeon General was put out the first Surgeon General's advisory in over a decade just last year, helping folks understand what naloxone is, helping them understand that over half of the overdoses that are occurring, are occurring in home environments, in bedrooms, in bathrooms, in garages. They're not occurring in the streets. And the only way we're going to turn around this opioid epidemic is if we all play a role, if we're all willing to do our part. It's such an honor to be here, and we have a limited amount of time, so I'm going to try to be efficient with my words. No jokes other than the one that I usually give to folks, because a lot of people don't know what the Surgeon General actually is or does. I'm not a surgeon nor a general. I'm an anesthesiologist, and I'm actually a vice admiral in the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. And the Commissioned Corps, we respond to disasters all over the country and all over the world. I deployed to the hurricanes during Maria and Harvey. And I got to tell you, my heart goes out to the folks who've lost their homes and some who've lost their lives due to the tornadoes that have gone through the Midwest just recently. As many of you know, I lived in Indiana for the last 20 years, and I was the head of the State Department of Health. So if I was still here, I would be the one out there right now going around to these communities and to these houses and surveying the damage and trying to help people recover. And so again, my prayers go out to all of you and your families as you all seek to recover from this terrible situation where only the community coming together is going to help people get back on their feet. But I also want to tell you a little bit about my own personal story. I'm known as the nation's doctor, but I really see my role as representing the nation's patient. And unfortunately, there's hardly a disease you can name that I haven't been afflicted by within my family. And neither of my grandfathers lived to collect Social Security. One died of a stroke. The other one died of complications from lung cancer. The irony there, and this is a whole other story, is that I worked in the tobacco fields growing up. So I actually helped contribute to an industry that ultimately killed my grandfather. And we can, if you have questions on that, we can talk about that. But it's directly fed into and informed a lot of the policy decisions that I make right now. Well, you brought up the brought up Antarctica. And one of the challenges that we have is that folks really do care about the environment. They really do care about the world that they're leaving for folks. But they care first and foremost about being able to pay their bills and feed their family. I knew tobacco was unhealthy. I knew it was the main ingredient in cigarettes. I grew up poor in a rural area. I also knew the only way I was going to be able to afford those Air Jordans or to go out on a date or to go out to the movies was to go out in the tobacco field and work. And so it wasn't that I was making a conscious decision to poison my environment or try to kill my grandfather. It was that I did what I had to do to pay the bills. And I think that's one of the struggles that we face when we're trying to figure out how to incorporate more public health into the U.S. consciousness is we go to places and we say things like, we're going to shut down the coal mines. And we don't think about the fact that 60% of the town is employed by the coal mines. And what they're hearing is, you're going to take away my ability to support my family. And so one of the things I've really tried to do as Surgeon General is make that connection between health and economic prosperity. Help folks understand that healthier communities are actually more prosperous communities, that they have higher wages, that they can bring in more jobs, that there's less absenteeism, there's greater productivity. And so I encourage you all to think about how you can help folks understand that health is critical to their priorities, because another thing that you may not want to hear me say at Cleveland Clinic is that folks don't vote on health. They don't. Number one issue people vote on is jobs and the economy. Number two issue people vote on is safety and security. But Democrat or Republican, and you can look up Gallup polls if you don't believe me, folks do not vote on health. They vote on health care in some cases. In the last election, Democrats, health care rose to the top three. Republicans, I don't think it made it to the top five. But even for health care, I would argue that it's a matter of their economic situation. They're not voting for health when they vote for health care. They're voting because one-fifth of every dollar that our economy generates now goes to pay for health care expenses. And so they can't pay their rent. They can't pay their car payment. They can't put money into their kids' college funds because they're spending so much of it on health care. So even that is an economic reason. And so we need to show folks that we can create cost savings, that we can create a more prosperous environment when we invest in health. Now, I'm jumping around a little bit, but I mentioned that I was the nation's, represented the nation's patient. My wife, just 2 weeks ago, finished treatment for metastatic melanoma. And so I want to thank all of you all for the work that you do here at Cleveland Clinic, because we absolutely want to make sure there's people around to help take care of folks once they fall into the stream. But we also want to make sure so darn many folks aren't falling into the stream in the first place. And speaking of falling into the stream, my baby brother Philip is in prison right now. He stole $200 to support his addiction and got a 10-year prison sentence. And that started with unrecognized, untreated anxiety and depression that led to self-medication with tobacco, then alcohol, then marijuana. And then one day, someone gave him a pill at a party. Quite frankly, a pill that maybe one of you all prescribed. Maybe a pill that I prescribed. Because as you all know, we were told that if you were giving pills for pain management, that folks wouldn't become addicted. And you were told that those pills wouldn't be diverted. But we know that 80% of heroin users out there, people like my brother, got started with a prescription opiate, and it usually came from someone else's medicine cabinet, and it was usually legitimately prescribed by someone like us, by one of our colleagues. So again, I bring a lot of expertise, I think, to the table from the medical and professional point of view, but I bring a lot of personal experience to the table from my own family's background and my own family's upbringing. Now I want to tell you really quickly about my priorities. One of the challenges of being Surgeon General is that every day there's 10 people waiting outside my office who want to meet with me and want me to make their priority my number one priority. We want you to make sickle cell your top priority. No, we want you to make type 1 diabetes your top priority. No, we want you to make melanoma your top priority. We want you to make my disease, what I care about, your top priority. And so one of the things that I've realized is that we're going to keep playing whack-a-mole over and over and over again if we take that approach. So I tried to pick cross-cutting priorities during my time as Surgeon General. Substance misuse as a broad category is one of my priorities. Why? Because in many cases, it's a symptom of more upstream issues, but also an opportunity to address upstream issues. So for instance, the opioid epidemic, terrible tragedy, but also a tremendous opportunity to help folks understand the need to address ACEs and trauma, the need to address mental health issues. Because again, my brother didn't use one of these substances, he used all of them. And that's the case for most folks who misuse substances. It's polysubstance abuse, and they're self-medicating away their mental or their physical pain. So I hope you use the opioid epidemic to talk about naloxone, but I hope you also use the opioid epidemic to talk about how we can get into the community and work upstream to prevent disease from occurring. And if we do that, then we'll have less cardiovascular disease, we'll have less cancer, we'll have less opioid misuse. Because ACEs and trauma lead to all three of those things in higher amounts. I also mentioned what people vote on, jobs in the economy, number one. So that's why I have a Community Health and Economic Prosperity Initiative. I want to help folks understand that investments in the community aren't bad, and community health aren't bad for business. they're actually good for business. And next year, we'll be putting out a report where we're cross-linking the data that shows that communities that have invested in health have more resilience, have higher wages, have less absenteeism, have greater productivity. I live in Washington, D.C. right now. You all may have heard of this little company called Amazon. It was a big fight over where they were going to put their second headquarters. Places even here in Ohio were fighting for those second headquarters. Anyone know where they ended up? They ended up in Crystal City, Virginia. And coincidentally, well, not coincidentally, if you look around Crystal City, Virginia, four of the top 20 healthiest cities in the United States surround Crystal City, Virginia. That is no coincidence. So communities that invest in health are able to attract young people, attract healthy workforces, and actually attract more business, greater tax revenue. It's why it's important that you all help the surrounding Cleveland community and all of Ohio understand the importance of addressing community health when it is poor and the benefits of raising up community health. I'm also focused on health and national security because the number two issue people vote on is safety and security. We go to Washington, D.C. And beg for nickels and dimes, and the Department of Defense backs up the Brinks truck, and they just say, how much do you want? Well, here's a shocking stat for you, a tweetable stat. 70%, 7 out of 10 of our 18 to 24-year-olds in this country are ineligible for military service right now because they can't pass the physical, they can't meet the educational requirements, so they have a criminal background record. And that all happens because of poor community health, lack of investments in communities. So if we can show people that we can help you achieve a safer and more secure country, we'll do a better job of getting more resources for the things that that we care about. Never thought that as Surgeon General in 2019, I'd be dealing with measles, but here we are. And again, I know a lot of you all are here from the cardiovascular crowd, but we all have a role to play in helping lift up the importance of vaccinations because this is what happens when we don't speak up for public health. This is what happens when we don't support proven interventions. We slowly start to backslide, and the next thing you know, you've got a measles outbreak going on. And then oral health. A long time ago, we cut the head off from the rest of the body. We said if you have a oral health issue, if you have a mental health issue, if you have a vision issue, here's a card, we'll see you later. We need to reattach the head to the body. We need folks to understand that you can't achieve physical health from the neck down if you don't pay attention to what's going on from the neck up. And so I'm actually working on an oral health report where next year we will be putting out the first Surgeon General's report in 20 years highlighting advancements in oral health and the need to address disparities. So I'm going to quickly go through here because I want to save time for questions. I encourage you all to go to surgeongeneral.gov, check out my Surgeon General's advisory on naloxone an opioid overdose. Be willing to carry naloxone. Any one of you can go into a pharmacy and carry it. I know you all know how to inject naloxone because you're a surgical crowd. These are the versions that you can get for take home. One's an intranasal version. It's kind of like a Flonase inhaler. You simply put it in the nostril and press. That's literally how easy it is to save a life. The other version is a auto-injector version. It actually talks to you, and you simply press. And again, that easy to save a life. I really encourage you all to get naloxone, to carry it, to show other people what it looks like, to show them how easy it is for them to save a life. I also want to highlight my Surgeon General's digital postcard. So how many of you all remember this guy called C. Everett Koop? So C. Everett Koop was dealing with a different crisis, a crisis of HIV, about 30 years ago. And he sent out a letter to everyone across America called Understanding AIDS. Anyone in the room remember that? A few people are nodding their heads. Because he wanted everyone to understand that they had a role to play in addressing the HIV epidemic. Well, I wanted to do the same thing, but my kids told me, Dad, no one uses snail mail anymore. So I put out a digital postcard which lists five steps that every American can take to respond to the opioid epidemic. Very simple steps, but very tangible steps. Locking up your prescription medications, carrying naloxone, understanding addiction, having a conversation with your family. So please, go to my Twitter, go to my Facebook, these are on there right now, and share it because the only way this is going to get to the country is if you all use your social media to help me share it and to help me spread it. Also want to highlight my advisory on e-cigarette use among youth. We're not going to go too much into this, but e-cigarette use in high school is up by 78%. We've seen use of tobacco products go down over the last decade. They're now starting to go back up again because of e-cigarettes. This truly is an epidemic, and I think it's very important, particularly for the cardiovascular crowd in here, to lean into tobacco misuse of all types and tobacco product misuse, and to talk about the unique risk that nicotine presents to young people. Again, I mentioned my Community Health and Economic Prosperity Initiative and the fact that 71% of young people are ineligible to serve in the military. Mentioned measles. Mentioned my report on oral health that I'm working on. I could talk to you all day long, but I want to save time for us to engage and for the councilmen, but I want to leave you with a couple of challenges. It's very, very much an honor to be here at the Cleveland Clinic. I worked at a level one trauma center for the last decade. I very much believe in the importance of having folks there to help you when you fall, to help pick you up. But the fact is, 80% of health is not health care. Let me put it another way. By most estimates, less than 15% of health actually is health care. The majority of health is behaviors. It's environment. It's the social determinants of health. And so we really need to think about what we can do to get upstream, because I'm convinced that a lot of the burnout that providers face is because we're on the hamster wheel. It's because no matter how good of a job you do here at Cleveland Clinic taking care of people when they fall into the stream, there's always going to be more people falling in than what you can fish out. And you feel like you're just doing the same thing over and over and over again and not getting a positive result. And as we all know, that's the definition of insanity. So I implore you to think about the ways you can lean into upstream interventions, starting off by finding out about your patient's social needs. We can talk about endocarditis during the question and answer session, but less than 10% of people who get surgery for endocarditis, who get valve surgery, actually get referred to medication-assisted treatment. So you can do the best surgery. You can have the best outcome in your episode of care, and then you send them back to the same environment without the interventions that we know will prevent them from misusing, and they show up in your hospital again 6 months, 12 months later. Is that going to prevent burnout? Is that going to make you feel satisfied with the work you're doing? Oh, here's Johnny again. We're going to work on him all over again. So really need you to lean into thinking about your patient's social needs, the social determinants of health. Also, try to lean into and pay attention to your own biases, the biases in your community, and what you can do to eliminate disparities. We like to pat ourselves on the back in many cases for pushing the averages down. But here's the dirty little secret. Many times as the averages go down, the disparities go up, because the resources tend to go to the communities that can most afford them. And again, I'm a very straightforward, transparent person. I love being here. Quite frankly, I'd love to work here one day. But I also know that just as the academic center where I worked at, the big house, as we call it in Indianapolis, in many cases, we're catering to the people who have insurance, who have the money, who have the resources, who can get here. And again, we're driving down the averages and we're patting ourselves on the back for innovating, but we aren't paying attention to the people out there who don't have the access to the great doctors at the Cleveland Clinic, to the great resources that you all have available here. So pay attention to the biases that exist in your community. And the final thing I would say is my motto is better health through better partnerships. I've learned that throughout my career, and we can talk about this too, but as many of you all know, I'm infamous or famous, depending on which way you slice the apple, because during the time I was state health commissioner in Indiana, we had the largest outbreak of HIV related to injection drug use in the history of the United States. And syringe service programs were illegal in Indiana at the time. And I had to work to get syringe service programs approved. And one of the things I'm most proud of, and I, to my dying day, I'll be proud of this, is that because of that work, we went to hundreds more syringe service programs across the country. People looked at what we did as a model. And while my medical partners were critically important, the first people I talked to, the people who were critical to getting that syringe service program over the finish line, were the local sheriff, the local business community, and the local faith-based community. because they were the ones who actually determined whether or not we were going to get these controversial policy solutions implemented in their community, in their rural, all-white, very religious community. And so we have to understand that we've got to break down these silos. We've got to step outside the Cleveland Clinic and take a walk into the communities that exist out there. We've got to figure out who are the stakeholders, who are the trusted resources, who are the trusted partners, and be willing to work with them and to be servant leaders. What's servant leadership? It's not telling other people what to do. I didn't go down to Scott County, Indiana, and tell them I'm going to fix your problem. I went down there and asked them, what are your concerns and how can I help you? I had a beer with the sheriff. I probably shouldn't say this at the Cleveland Clinic. But I said, Sheriff, what are your concerns? And the sheriff said, my concerns are my law enforcement officers are getting stuck by needles. My concerns are my jail's overcrowded. And I said, well, you know, Sheriff, that's a valid concern. Very important. Very important that you validate people's feelings, that you first are humble enough to ask them what their concerns are, and then that you validate their feelings. And I said, that's a very valid concern. I said, you know, if we work together to put this syringe service program in place, the statistics show that it will lower needle stick injuries to law enforcement by 60%, and will connect people to care, and less people will end up in your jails, and it will actually make life easier for you and for your law enforcement colleagues. And so after doing that, the sheriff actually was the one who went to bat for the syringe service program for the proven medical intervention. But it would have never happened if I stood on my high horse in Indianapolis and said, I know what's best for you guys, and you're a bunch of dumb yokels if you don't do it. And we tend to do that far too often from our ivory towers. So again, please embrace my motto of better health through better partnerships. Realize you're just going to keep getting more and more burned out if you don't really look upstream, if you don't try to partner outside of the buildings in which we work each and every day. And it doesn't mean that what you do isn't critically important, but it means that it's got to be additive on top of the measures that actually improve overall community health, and not instead of, not replacing those investments upstream. So that said, I want to leave some time for the councilman, and then we'll take some questions at the end. But I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here, and I hope you invite me back, because I would love to come and have a longer and more in-depth conversation with you on some of these issues. But that's just a sprinkling of what's going through my mind as your Surgeon General, the things that we're working on, why we're working on those projects, and how I hope we can work together to improve not just health care, but health and prosperity for each and every one of our citizens across this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Surgeon General. We'd love to have you back another time. And on the practical side, your naloxone administration was very good. I presume that, you know, being an anesthesiologist, you had a little local anesthetic before you punched yourself there. But on the practical side, in Cuyahoga County, our mortality rate for drug overdose is 21%. There are some places where it's lower. And, you know, getting naloxone into the squads, into the hotels, schools, etc., obviously is a key part of this. What highlighted this problem for me personally was I took my wife and we went to visit the Bridges of Ashtabula, which is well worthwhile doing if you haven't done it. And we were out there and we drove through a little village. It happens to be called Jefferson Village. I counted one traffic light. But at their community building, on the front lawn, they had black flags for all of their community who had died from drug overdoses. And there were probably about 50 of them. It was astoundingly striking and sad to see. And so as part of that, I thought it would be important to have a local perspective. And as I mentioned, Councilman Griffin and I've had some work together. He works obviously very closely with the mayor at Jackson on a lot of these issues, and it would be important to give his perspective and how we as physicians at the Cleveland Clinic can help our local community and what inputs he'd like to see from us. Thank you very much, Councilman.
Thank you, Dr. Svensson. And Thank you, Dr. Svensson, and also thank you, Dr. Adams. I really appreciate you coming here to Cleveland, and I thought that your presentation was exhilarating, and thank you for the demonstration, because I always thought the way to revive somebody from opioid addiction is the demonstration showed on Pulp Fiction, when they actually stabbed a man in the heart, and you actually showed that that's not advisable to all of the medical professionals in here, so.
Well, I love it, but that's an important point, because that actually is, even though we laugh, that actually is what a lot of people think of when they think I'm going to intervene, and they're scared to do it, and so it's so important that you're willing to carry it, that you can talk about it, that you can say how easy it is. Heck, on your social media channels, do a demonstration of it and show folks how easy it can be. So that the communities that have been able to turn around their opioid overdose rates across the country, and I travel across the country, are the ones that have first started with saturating the community with naloxone. Because you can't get someone into recovery if they're dead.
Right. Well, I'll tell you a personal story. The year is 2016, and the greatest team that ever played NBA basketball, the Cleveland Cavaliers, were about to play to win the championship. And I ran to the store for a brief moment around the corner from where I live in the community that I serve. And there was a gentleman that was in the car, and he looked kind of strange. He was kind of nodding off. And I went to the store, got some items. When I came back out, I realized that he was still in the, you know, still nodding off and still really out of sorts. So I ran into the, you know, supermarket that was around the corner from my home, and I got the police officer. The police officer came, and thankfully he had naloxone. And ever since then, I realized how important it was for community members, just everyday people, to have naloxone. Because, you know, even though the officer was able to save that man's life, I could have had naloxone and did the same thing. So I think that's very important. But what you're talking about is so important about catching a lot of these issues upstream. And as I'm the chair of Health and Human Services for the City of Cleveland, Cleveland City Council, one of the things we try to focus on, lead is a big issue right now that we're really focused on, but it's all of the social determinants of health that you talked about and how we can catch them upstream. Infant mortality, lead crisis, preschool admission, low educational attainment, crushing poverty, trauma, violence, lost production, and then also the addiction problem that you're talking about. In our opinion, all of these things are inextricably tied. And one of the things we try to look at this is from a whole model of how can we make a healthy community. So we feel in the city of Cleveland, having the premier medical institution in the United States and living in, you know, some of the areas around this institution in poverty, that we need to make sure that we have a healthier community. So we're working on all of these, and opioid crisis is definitely one of the major issues that we're dealing with. Dr. Svensson mentioned about over the weekend, we had a lot of deaths with opioids. And one of the things that the medical examiner realized is that there was an uptick in African-Americans that were the victims of these,
50%
these deaths.
50% this weekend were African-American.
Yeah. And it was because of lace that they actually were using what they thought was cocaine. And they actually, you know, had fentanyl in there. And one of the things that I tell everybody is with the 21st century technology, all of the educational tools that we have is that we have to be smarter at how we look at healthcare. And you mentioned jobs and economic development. You mentioned safety and security. I think if you don't have good health and a healthy community, there's no chance of you having a prosperous life and a good job and economic development, nor is there an opportunity for you to have safety and security. So I think all of those are tied together. You know, we look at a lot of the faith-based community, which we think have a big role. And a lot of this community has a lot of churches that saturate the area. But also, one of the things that I would tell the people in this community is that we often sometimes have to use what I call indigenous leadership. If you walk up and down, and I like what you said, and actually I have to give credit to Dr. Mihaljevic, because he actually did go out and walk in the neighborhoods with me. And we didn't just stay on the main streets. We actually walked down a couple of alleys, down a few of the back streets, because it was important for me to really try to have him get a sense and a feel for the neighborhood. But when you look at some of the indigenous leadership, a Mrs. Jones that live in the neighborhood, we talk to young kids that live in the neighborhood. Some of these young kids have influence. Some of these guys that are formerly incarcerated that live in the neighborhood, to really help them educate, you know, the community on why this is so important that we get educated on these kind of issues is critical. And I will say this, and, you know, I'll turn it over to Dr. Svensson. I will say this. that this opioid addiction has been plaguing minority and poor communities for a long time. Sometimes things don't reach the height of awareness until it affects certain groups. Mm-hmm. And this issue started affecting affluent communities the last 4, 5, 6 years or so, and it became a national crisis. Well, I would tell you, in some poor and minority communities, it's been a crisis for a long time.
Absolutely.
And we're glad that the Calvary is here to continue to work with us, but it's an important example that we have to look at, is that these type of social issues and these type of health disparities don't stay contained in a certain area for long. Eventually, it'll come to a neighborhood and community near you. So as a lot of the medical professionals that are here today, and as you so eloquently talked about today, it's important to really try to drive home with these communities that are surrounding us right here. How can we become more involved? How can we build better partnerships in order to have a healthy community? How can we look at policies, look at technology? How can we make sure that we do forums like this, which next time, I was caught a little bit off guard today, but next time I will have more community residents that will be here to be a part of this as well. So thank you, Dr. Svensson, and Dr. Adams, I look forward to spending the day with you to talk about all of the things that we're doing in Cleveland.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. You know, the councilman hit a key point. I mean, and I just love the examples that you brought up, because if I asked you all in the crowd to give me the most cost-effective medical interventions from this crowd, you'd name surgeries, you'd name procedures. But I tell you what, more effective than most of the surgeries that you all do each and every day at promoting health is actually preschool. And you've got to ask yourself, how many times have you been out there promoting preschool as an intervention to help lift up the health of your residents in your community? And again, it's not that it's not that what you do is not important. It's that it's got to be coupled with an overall effort to turn off the spigot. So thank you.
And I'm going to take this opportunity to do a shameless plug. And we have a school that somebody is attempting to close in this neighborhood. And that doesn't just affect this neighborhood. That affects everybody in here. They're talking about closing down Bolton School, which is a public option, which is critical. If we're going to be effective with health disparities and those kind of issues, and in an area like this that we have, the Cleveland Clinic, I think it's essential for us to have a good educational option here. So that's one of the things that I do want to take a shameless plug, let everybody know why you have to be involved in the neighborhood around you.
And we're having a back and forth. So I want to tell you, I love stories. I took my son to Notre Dame because Notre Dame asked me to give a lecture there. And the whole time up, where it's about a 3-hour drive, I was telling my 11-year-old son at the time, we're going to one of the richest, the nicest, the best schools in the entire country. And we're driving and he's getting all excited and we get into South Bend, Indiana, to St. Joe County. And he starts looking around and he goes, "This is the nicest area in the whole one of the nicest schools." And it's amazing because you go there, and St. Joe County has a lot of health disparities, a lot of issues. But then you cross over the threshold, and it really is like the gates of heaven opened, and you step on the Notre Dame's campus. But that is not an anomaly. Johns Hopkins, same thing. And I was in Baltimore just this weekend. You're driving around Hopkins, same thing. The top research-funded schools in the entire nation are disproportionately in poorer communities. And we create these great great programs where we go overseas. We go to Africa. We go to South America. We go to all these other places to lift up health there. And those are good things, but we don't do anything about the community that we drive through to get to our pearly gates each and every day. And so again, the challenge is to try to take some of what you've got here and push it further out into the surrounding community and lift that up, because it really is just a travesty when you look at these research institutions and then you look at their surrounding communities and you realize how much money sits within this bubble and how much research and innovation and influence sits within this bubble, but how little of it tends to spill over into the rest of the community.
And if I could, Dr. Svensson, that's one of the, and I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that we have that I've been in support of is a biorepository that's going to be coming up on Cedar Road that is being sponsored and being supported by the Cleveland Clinic. And I think the numbers tell me that there's about 700 to 800 samples that are scattered across the campus that we're now trying to consolidate. But I want to make sure we get a community benefit out of that. How do we take advantage of that precision medicine so that we can make sure that we have treatments and other type of things that affect African-American communities? I think the numbers that I've looked at have shown that most of the research are done on predominantly white men and women. And when you look at blood pressure medicines, you know, African-Americans or Hispanic community or other communities may react different. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we look at that research and development that our community takes care of. But we do have to overcome some stigmas like the Tuskegee Institute and other places in order to really try to make sure that the community understands that this is something that can help benefit us. Sorry, Dr.
Thank you very much. I mean, both of you emphasized some very important principles about the local community, obviously education, starting at the very early age, nutrition, and helping the local community. I wanted to introduce and also ask our other members of the panel to come up in alphabetical order as they come up. Will be Steve Gordon, who's our head of infectious diseases and deals particularly with the endocarditis patients. Then we have Adam Myers, who's head of 4C, which is our population health and our primary care institute. Jester Pedersen, our world-famous heart surgeon on operating on endocarditis and has written a lot about this. David Stream, who helps us with rehabbing our patients. We send consults right away to our psychiatry team to deal with the patients as they come in, even before they have surgery. And Brendan Patterson, who used to be at Metro, but many of you may not know, he's our new institute chair for rheumatology and orthopedics. And Brendan has had, as with the Surgeon General, a long interest in the use of non-opioids for managing pain. So let me just start with Brendan from your end and just some comments about your interest and what you're dealing with and you need leading the initiative here at the Cleveland Clinic on trying to switch away from opioids.
Right. And, you know, I think there's we're just beginning to capture some of these opportunities. As Dr. Adams well knows, there's lots of different alternatives for procedural pain management. And we're looking at non-opioid approaches, and we're having tremendous success in areas like C-section, where up to 45 to 50% of our patients now are opioid-free. Thankfully, women deliver babies, because I don't think we'd have that same success if men had delivered babies. And I think we're just beginning to capture the benefits of electronic medical record in helping us define registries, identifying patients at risk, and developing tailored approaches for pain management based upon AI and some of the analysis we can do with large databases.
I think a key point here is that we're at a watershed moment in terms of shifting from fee for service to pay for outcomes and pay for value. And this is critically important because when you talk about pain management, and I know you know this, one of the challenges is we tend to do what we get paid to do. And it's why, in many cases, you had opioids overprescribed, because it was easier and it was cheaper. If we really embrace the shift to pay for outcomes, then that obviates the need to fight piecemeal over which procedure you're going to pay for. Because then you say, look, deliver me the outcome. Deliver me a patient who can get back to function and who we aren't subjecting to a lifetime of addiction to opioids down the road. And however you choose to get there is your decision. Within Cleveland Clinic, you all figure out how you divvy up the funding, but deliver us the outcome. And if you actually save money, then that money comes back to you. I don't know if you have thoughts about that, but...
Well, you know, this is where, you know, if we were to greenfield this, we would ask the government to give us all the money.
Well, that there's $25 billion potentially coming.
All the money, and we would spend it in preschool. you know, a lot of our costs are related to problems that are developed at age 4, 5, 6, and 7. And if we're going to be responsible for outcomes long term, we would have a much better ROI if we invested in children.
Well, that's a good point, Brandon, and Congress is now beginning to debate a bill for $25 billion to help, and I'm sure a lot of that will be to that early period education. So, David, let me give you a chance to comment on particularly Matt and how are you dealing now with the opioid crisis and managing also our patients from HVI.
Well, I think that the particularly the problem of endocarditis represents a larger issue, which is the priority and the importance of seizing opportunities to introduce patients, people in crisis, people suffering from the disease of addiction, and to get those folks into treatment and help them to work through the underlying psychiatric problems, the trauma and the bipolar disorder and other types of psychiatric problems that a lot of times contribute to addiction problems. Too often we focus on the immediate threat to life, and then we often don't feel like we have the skills to seize the opportunity to get folks into the proper treatment and to really talk to them about that. So Dr. Adams mentioned, you know, the use of naloxone, and that's a tremendous opportunity to be able to talk with someone about, with a patient about those opportunities that they have to get into treatment. We have peer support in emergency rooms now within the health system that's tremendously helpful with that. And then, of course, when patients come into the hospital and have endocarditis, you know, I get the opportunity to work with them, and it's just a great opportunity to have a profound impact on one person's life. There was a published report in 2017 about an endocarditis case in rural Georgia that took up over 2 years, 7 hospitalizations, 1 mitral valve replacement, at least $400,000 worth of costs. But because there wasn't MAT and addiction treatment available, by all accounts, all of that effort, all of that expenditure did not lead to the kind of outcomes that Dr. Adams was mentioning and that we all hope for. So this is an opportunity, and I think if we prepare ourselves to seize that opportunity, I think all of us have a role to play, particularly in an organization like the clinic, where we're all in this together. We're all one big team.
You mentioned peer recovery coaches, and you mentioned working in the community. What I don't want folks to leave here thinking is that they have to do everything themselves. You don't. There are community health workers. There are peer recovery support services out there. What we need to do a better job of is connecting people with the resources that already exist in the community that can result in a warm handoff so that when that person comes into the ER, you can identify the problem, and then you can say, let's connect you with the church group. Let's connect you with the peer recovery support group, with the nonprofit that will help you transition into a better life and into recovery.
So one of the things I think we'll look into for our HVI physicians is to see if we can provide naloxone for our physicians. I mean, you know, obviously we travel in our local community and we are out at restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll see if we can implement that. Yester, what comments do you have about endocarditis and your experience in dealing with the patients with the opioid-related endocarditis?
Yeah, we work with these guys to my side here, and we are, of course, extremely aware of the importance of treating both conditions. These patients have two fatal conditions, and if we don't treat both, it's a waste of money. And our small role as cardiac surgeon is try to prevent them from dying. And we also try to prevent them from getting devastating complications from this very serious disease. And we have another powerful tool in our hands, and that is actually to connect to these patients. And, you know, I have patients who call my office, and I'll spend 30 seconds occasionally to talk to them, and I think it has an impact, and it makes me happy every time one of these patients called my office and tell my secretary I'm drug-free for 22 months, that happens the other day, and so. So I think that that is also part. They need to be seen, they need to be recognized that they are valuable human beings and we're not throwing them away. I think that that's what we can do in addition to saving their lives.
I think you can use your voices too. There is not a disease that I can immediately think of that more acutely represents the cost of addiction to the community than endocarditis. And I dealt with an HIV epidemic, lifetime cost of about $400,000 to $500,000. Hepatitis, again, lifetime cost of several hundred thousand dollars. An episode of endocarditis, just a few weeks, you're hitting several hundred thousand dollars. And I think you all need to use your voices and help folks understand that whether, regardless of how you feel morally about these individuals, it just does not make financial sense to continue operating in a fashion where we're waiting for these folks to present with endocarditis and then addressing their issues versus dealing with them upstream.
All right. Going now to 4C, you're on the front lines and dealing with, Adam, the primary care doctors. You know, patients go back to the community. You have to deal with the issues and trying to keep patients drug-free. What are your thoughts?
A couple of things. My first exposure to addiction as a reality was actually prior to going to medical school. I helped open and operate a shelter for homeless men in the most impoverished area of Louisiana. And there was one gentleman who came in who was about 35 years old. And when he was 8 years old, he was watching Tom and Jerry cartoons one morning, on a Saturday morning. And his mother was gone. Her boyfriend was there watching him for a while. And he had the novel idea of, wonder what would happen if I injected this 8-year-old boy with cocaine. So he did. His N of one revealed that from that point on, every waking moment for this young man was an effort for his next hit. And finally, I think when I left, he was on a path that was better than that. But this is a community problem. And it has been, as you've both said, affecting many of the communities in our nation for much longer than we've been highlighting it. And I'm glad we're now highlighting it. But part of that response involves us embracing the community more effectively than we have, and that's part of what we're working on here. I will say additionally, and echo some additional points that have been made, much of what happens in the world of addiction right now is an effort to self-medicate for otherwise undiagnosed or ineffectively treated psychiatric and behavioral issues. And I think that needs to be strengthened and burgeoned as we work to improve this challenge. We're doing a good job right now of seeking other ways to approach pain. Our dialogue around pain is shifting. Our dialogue around how we alleviate pain and not totally remove pain is shifting, and we're seeking non-opioid solutions to much of what we do in the area of pain, which is wonderful. But I will also add one other piece of this that is I don't hear a lot of dialogue about, and it might be interesting to get your input on it. We are now, because of the breadth of this problem, facing a growing number of people in our communities that are recovered and recovering addicts. Mm-hmm. Yeah. At some point or another, many of them will need to interface with us as healthcare providers again, in urgent or elective manners that involve pain. And all too often, we do not do a good job of taking into account their history of addiction when we treat them again, and we then propagate and become part of their next spiral in life. And so I think we would do well to impact the communities, focus on the behavioral medicine, do what we've been doing to find replacements and other ways to focus on mitigating pain, but also address this piece. How do we change what we do and incorporate that in and not act reflexively when these addicts come back for our care that oftentimes involves pain and do so in such a way that doesn't create the next spiral?
And I think that's a challenge for you all here at Cleveland Clinic. I've been around the country and folks are grappling with this, and we need to come up with literally an entirely new specialty. An entire, you know, groups of individuals who are trained to deal with folks who are now in recovery. Now that we have so many folks who are in this situation, we need you all to come up with the best models, and then we need you to use interventions like Project Echo to push out best practices to the surrounding communities. Completely agree with you. It's an issue, and as we start to hit the crest of the wave, we're now going to have to deal with how do we reintegrate people back into society, get them jobs? How do we deal with them when they show back up for new healthcare encounters so that we don't re-traumatize them over and over again? How do we give our primary care providers out in communities the tools that they need to successfully deal with folks? Because, again, everyone can't drive into the Cleveland Clinic to get their care, even when you all come up with the best models.
Yeah, we have to assume it's touching everyone and act accordingly.
Steve, let me give you an opportunity to comment. You particularly have dealt with the infectious diseases, as Councilman and the Surgeon General mentioned. I mean, it's not just the addiction, it's all the long-term consequences of Hep C, hepatitis B, HIV, et cetera. Comments?
So again, thanks for
and
the
And can you tell me how to fix the measles situation?
Vaccinations.
Yeah,
so I love seeing, you know, as an ID person, we'd much rather prevent a disease than treat it, and I think we would all agree. And I think you're you know, seeing that measles thing up in 2019, it breaks our hearts a little bit. And there's a bigger story behind that, as you know, in terms of social media, in terms of person's beliefs. And now CDC is pushing back, and I think that that's good. I think, you know, for me, there's a lot of parallels. I mean, I'm old enough that when I was an EIS officer at CDC, Everett Koop was our Surgeon General, and he was a man that obviously was a surgeon and came into a situation where he didn't waste a crisis and talked openly about HIV and prevention. As I look at this, I think there's many parallels, and I do believe as an ID doc, I can take a good sexual history. Not many people do, including primary care. I can take a very good now drug abuse history. Not many people can or do. We have to look at the warning signs in terms of track marks, recognizing these signs. These people have a timeline. By the time we see most patients here, they're no longer having fun, and we're way distal down. And I see what my colleagues do in terms of able to save lives, but that's the tip of the iceberg. We need to push this back, as you said. So early recognition, early then referrals. And we need to learn more about the power of addiction. Not all addictions are bad. Most of us are addicted to work in this regard. But we don't understand the basic biology of a lot of addictions. That includes addiction to food, addiction to our cell phones in terms of this nature. And we don't have a great armamentarium. The drugs we're using, we talk about medication-assisted treatment, but as you know, that's for opioids only. We don't have that for cocaine or for MET or other issues, and we only have really three drugs. There has not been new drug development. We're beginning to see new ways of long-acting Suboxone now. But I would say is, after listening to you and how could I say, empathic you are, and how transparent, and that's the other thing. There's a stigma with these patients. If you talk to these patients, most of them don't come to healthcare and have had a great experience. And there's a stigmatization. So now we talk about what we say patient's first language. It's a person who injects drugs. Mm-hmm. It's a person with an opioid use disorder or a substance use disorder. It is not some of the other terms mm-hmm. that are pejorative that we have heard or that we use in our training. We need to humanize, we need to recognize, and then we need to learn from our patients.
And I think that's another thing that I would challenge you all to do at Cleveland Clinic is really to lean into trauma-informed care. How do you teach everyone from the person at the reception desk when someone first comes in all the way through to the last person to see them when they're walking out the door to deliver trauma-informed care so that we're not discouraging people from coming in, so that we're not re-traumatizing them and causing more emotional pain when they're working their way through the healthcare system? So your remarks are spot on, sir.
So, Surgeon General, you know, we've talked about the early education, and obviously we try and intervene before the epidemic develops, the problems develop, the mental health issues develop. And you touched on something that I think is very important, and that is that the military does not accept a lot of the people who would really benefit from treatment. And as you know, in the Vietnam War, one of the big struggles that the U.S. Army learned to deal with, or the U.S. military, was the issue of drug addiction at that time. And as an admiral, and I presume you can tell the general something, is what is the opportunity, maybe not a conscription, obviously everybody's all men in the United States, their names are written down and for potential conscription, but what is the opportunity of maybe having a opportunity for a year for people to be in the military where a lot of these social issues can be addressed, mental health, drug addiction, early education, getting, you know, kids, especially young men, into an education program where they better understand and maybe get that extra start to get into trades or whatever. What are your thoughts about that? Because we clearly aren't winning in this fight. Yes, we can use naloxone, we can save people, but we need to start much further, in surgical terms, proximally, to deal with this issue.
Well, I was just at the Pentagon yesterday. I've been working with the Surgeons General of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and really leaning into our health and national security initiative from a couple of vantage points. Another shocking statistic, there are 20 veterans each day who die by suicide. 20 every single day. And here's what's more shocking, is we tend to think that maybe there's something that happened during the time they were in the military that caused it. But what actually they found is that in most cases, it's what happened before they joined the military. That in many cases, these folks had adverse childhood experiences before they joined the military, had trauma. And then they went into the military to find that family, to find that camaraderie, to find that discipline. And then they leave the military, and they're left hanging out there in the wind. And a lot of them try to take their lives. And so we've been working to try to figure out the overlap with the military, to lift it up as a national security initiative. But also, the flip side is we know that kids who have adverse childhood experiences aren't doomed to negative outcomes, but that the biggest predictor of whether or not they're going to have a negative or a positive outcome is a positive adult role model in their life. And so in many cases, if we can take folks in uniform and bring them into schools and in the communities and get them off the bases and have them be coaches on teams and have them work with young people in communities like the communities that surround Cleveland Clinic here, that in many cases we can lift up those people when they're young. They can become our next soldiers and members of the uniformed services, which helps our national security, and it provides that positive feedback and that sense of relationship with the community to the folks who were in the military, which gives them resilience moving on down the road. It's really trying to find those communal win-win-wins and to break down those silos.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you very much for our panel. Very much a great thank you, Surgeon General, for coming, and Councilman for joining us. Let's give them a great round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. We welcome your comments and feedback. Please contact us at heart@ccf.org. Like what you heard? Please subscribe and share the link on iTunes.